Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Tehran says no direct negotiations with the U.S. are on the table. President Trump stopped short of directly blaming Iran for a major attack on Saudi Arabian oil installations. Tim Shorn is Director of International Studies and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Tonight at SDSU in Brookings at 7 p.m., Dr. Shorn presents on the history and future of U.S.-Iranian relations. That's in the Oscar Larson Performing Arts Center, but he joins us first on the phone for an update and perspective on some unfolding international drama. Dr. Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So our relations with Iran are strained, but that doesn't seem to be anything new. What is new in sort of how things are unfolding right now?
Well, I think if we're looking at something new, it's the potential for what in the past has essentially been kind of a Cold War and diplomatic disconnection between the United States and Iran, potentially erupting into a hotter war. I don't think either country necessarily wants direct military engagement against the other, but it appears that both countries have a habit of backing themselves into a corner when it comes to dealing with each other, and trying to find a way out of that corner is going to be perhaps difficult.
How much of what's happening now is being tied to the U.S., getting rid of this Iranian nuclear deal?
I think that is just one of the many symptoms of a really bad Iranian-United States relationship that really goes back to the 1950s. And in our current administration, there's a real mistrust about what Iran's intentions are, what their current activities are in the Middle East, and what they could potentially do over the next, anywhere from a few months to a few years. So I think really what we're looking at now is just one more step in a long and rather poor relationship.
Does that feel linear to you? Does it feel cyclical?
It feels pretty linear. I mean, we can go back to 1953 when the United States helped lead the overthrow of a democratically elected prime minister, Dr. Mossadegh. Clearly, after the Shah came back into power, real power in 1953 following the coup, we had good relations until 1979. And so in that way, it's a bit like a pendulum. But since 1979, it has been a consistent process of poor relations, misunderstandings, and really a lack of desire on probably both sides to move forward in a meaningful way.
So take me back to 1979, and I mean, this is a lot is happening there. What are some of the events of that time that you still see the seeds blossoming today?
When we look at 1979, we saw parties both within Iran and outside Iran, Iranian parties, willing to challenge the almost complete and total power of the Shah. The Shah was clearly one of our very good friends in the region. He was there to help lend stability to the region. He was there to ensure we had military access to the region. And of course, there was the oil aspect as well. Additionally, we had a market for our arms systems. We helped to create his secret police. And so there were very deep ties with the Shah's government. But the Shah also ruled with an iron fist. And the people of Iran understood that iron fist wasn't possible without American support. And so when Ayatollah Khomeini led the revolution, the Islamic revolution against the Shah, they were also leading a revolution against American influence in Iran and subsequently in the region. And of course, we know that later in 1979, Iranian students seized the American embassy and took hostages and the new Islamic Republic, rather than ordering the students to return the hostages, moved to a policy of support. And so that really poisoned relations. But it was there were two reasons for the poisoned relations. One was we were very unhappy with losing a very loyal ally in the region. So we were upset about that. Second, we were also very upset about, you know, essentially the ignoring of all kind of diplomatic conventions and taking our diplomats hostage. And then following that, while those were the two basic planks of our discontentment toward the current Iranian government, we also learned to be very concerned about Iran's role in the region, and that especially harmed us then in 1983. Excuse me. And in 1983, we saw the bombing of the American Marine barracks outside of Beirut, and we pointed the accusatory finger with some real reason behind that. We pointed the finger at Iran for being primarily responsible for that attack and the deaths of over 240 American Marines. And so starting in 1979 and through 1983, as far as the United States was concerned, every step that the government of Iran took and that the Islamic Republic took was a step against our interests, right, and a very harmful step to our interests.
And so as we, you know, sort of touch base with what's happening today and this attack on oil facility in Saudi Arabia, bring me back to the early 90s and our partnership with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf War. Now we're talking about the invasion of Kuwait and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And how does that intersect with Iran?
Well, part of the problem vis-a-vis Iran with that beginning in 1990 was a ramping up of the military presence, the American military presence in the Gulf. And obviously, while it was initially targeted against Iraq, Iran was not unaware of the fact that that military force could have been turned against them. And we have to remember, during the decade-long Iran-Iraq war, the United States very openly supported the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein against Iran. And so there was that bad blood. And then, of course, with the presence of American military forces in Iran, Iran became somewhat concerned. And then I think perhaps there was a bit of a misstep on the part of the United States following that. And that revolved around our almost unquestioning support for the Saudi regime. And consequently, I think the Saudis came to believe that as long as they had an incredibly loyal ally who was unquestionably backing them, they could essentially strike out in any direction they wanted. And that direction tended to be against Iran and the Shiites. And so now we've created a bit of a monster that the Saudis don't have to temper their activities, because they know that if they get caught in a bad situation, we are there to pull their chestnuts out of the fire.
Yeah. Give us some examples of that. There certainly have been some recent examples of some head-scratching sort of things that why America would accept from Saudi Arabia.
Certainly. I mean, we can look, for example, at the Saudi involvement in Yemen right now. This is not the first time that the Saudis have been involved in essentially a civil war in Yemen. And so Yemen has long been a place of interest to the Saudis. But now they feel essentially free to take any actions that they so desire to counter what they see as Iranian influence in Yemen and protect their sphere of influence in Yemen. And consequently, they are also rather unwilling to control the type of force that they use against the Houthi rebels and the impact on Yemeni civilians. So that's one area where the Saudis feel that they can act with impunity because they have America in their corner. Also, it appears that we have given them cover to essentially take on their opposition in any way they deem fit. And we saw that with the murder of the journalist Mr. Khashoggi, I'll get that right, and also then the arrest of human rights activists and opposition leaders within Saudi Arabia as well. And the United States did really very little to challenge that type of force and violence being used by the Saudis against their own citizens. So once again, it seems that we have given our imprimatur to any type of action that the Saudi government wants to take. And at some point, it's possible that they're going to take too big of a bite, and they're going to need us to come in and assist them. And then we're going to be in the position of, you know, militarily supporting a rather thuggish government.
All right. So the question there is why? Is that an unprecedented relationship? Is this just once the United States decides that, you know, we have an ally? Is it about arms deals? Is it about oil? Why is our relationship with Saudi Arabia so firm that we would not even provide cautionary warnings, you know, against some of this behavior?
The United States has a long history of kind of finding a particular enemy and then using just about any means possible to counter that enemy. We certainly saw it in the Cold War, in our fight against communism and the Soviets. And now we look at it as a fight against, initially it was Sunni Islamism in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And then eventually we return to confronting Iran and Iranian revolutionary Shiism. And the Saudis are our person in that fight, that if we don't want to become actively involved in ourselves, we need a proxy. And in that case, the proxy is Saudi Arabia. And we have a history of deciding that, look, if somebody is working with us to fight a more dangerous enemy, we're willing to look the other way when they take actions that would, you know, seemingly violate our own values. We can look back to during the Cold War when we supported particular South American dictatorships in Argentina, in Chile, in Latin America. And certainly we looked the other way when those dictators were making their opponents disappear, when they were employing death squads. So the fact that we are backing unreservedly a dictatorial government that is willing to use rather thuggish means is nothing new. The enemy of the day for the United States is currently Iran. And Iran is an easy target because we've had rather poor relations with them since 1979. And so I think that's one reason American habits become somewhat ingrained, find the enemy and oppose them and use nearly any means possible. But then there is also this desire to, you know, have a market for our arms industry. There is also a desire to keep oil flowing freely, that while we don't depend on the Saudis nearly as much as we used to, we have friends and allies who do. And if their economies suffer, our economy suffers. And so I think we back the Saudis for a number of reasons, and I don't see that changing. And honestly, it's something that most Republican and Democratic administrations do. Perhaps this particular administration is a little less willing to confront the Saudis when they cross a line, but most American administrations since the 1940s and 50s have been perfectly willing to support the Saudis.
This administration has also shown a willingness to engage in dialogue with people like Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un. So it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to think that President Trump would have an unconventional way to address leadership in Iran. How come this is different than, you know, or is it? Do you see signs of him being willing to sit? He seems to be willing to sit down with people who previously, I mean, he's taken heat for that.
Right. And I think this is a case where President Trump may, you know, maybe later today, maybe a month down the road, decide that, look, I am willing to meet with either Ayatollah Khamenei or President Rouhani. I'm willing to meet with either one, that I think I can accomplish more face-to-face, and he may decide that. And although it's going to, you know, it does take two to tango, Iran is going to have to believe that there is something positive that they're going to get out of sitting down with an American president, and they don't walk away looking weaker vis-a-vis the Saudis or others in the neighborhood. So I think it's very possible that in the future we see a President Trump and an Iranian leader sitting down to talk. And honestly, that might be the only way that we're going to see America and Iran backing down from this, you know, continuous line of confrontation. Certainly, we saw the United States step back from its normally kind of bilateral confrontational relationship with Iran when we saw the negotiations for the nuclear agreement. But obviously, what President Obama accomplished through the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was not something that the Trump administration agreed with. So we're kind of back to the status quo ante agreement. And but it could be that President Trump will actually decide, all right, I've met with others. I'm going to go ahead and sit down and meet with an Iranian leader, and I'll see what I can accomplish on my own. And so it's not at all beyond the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm.
You also don't see President Trump, or at least I haven't seen yet, maybe you have, sort of engaging in the kind of, you know, dialogue he did regarding North Korea, where he would call Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, or, you know, there was a taunting back and forth. You don't really see that happening here. Do you sort of see, as you look at his communication about the situation in the Middle East, that maybe there's the president is exhibiting, you know, the influence, a calming influence of other people in the administration, or a different awareness, a different relationship than the way he sort of addressed, you know, the kind of taunting back and forth and threats that he had with North Korea's dictator?
I think President Trump's, you know, whether it's a rhetoric or a willingness to engage, all comes from President Trump, that he is rather immune to, oftentimes immune to the influence of others. And I think if he determines that he needs to ratchet up the rhetoric and to include name calling against the Iranians, he will do so. And if he decides that he wants to meet with them, he will go full bore forward on meeting with them. That I really think it's going to come down to a personal decision of the president, and it could be supported by members of the administration. It might be opposed by members of the administration, but ultimately, it is going to be a unilateral decision by the president to engage in rhetoric, to not engage, to engage diplomatically, or to not engage.
Those members of the administration are shifting, and we saw the departure of people like John Bolton. Does the changing faces in the Trump administration, does that matter?
I'm not sure it does. President Trump is willing to take advice from someone, or at least listen to them, until he is not willing to do so. And I think that makes American foreign policy somewhat less predictable and somewhat more arbitrary. And it sends out confusing messages both to our allies and non-allies. Now, at times, that can be a positive step, but at other times, it leads to instability and insecurity. And with the turnover that we have seen in the Defense Department, in the State Department, in intelligence, in the National Security Council, it really makes it more difficult to predict what Americans' policy is going to be, because there is also no common thread between the various holders of those offices.
Right.
Obviously, anybody in those positions serve at the will of the president, but part of the definition of the will of the president, I would argue, is to also understand what it is the president wants to accomplish, and even perhaps how he wants to accomplish it. And that's what's missing right now. And the constant turnover makes it that much more difficult to ascertain what it is the president wants to achieve. Now, in the case of Iran, President Trump did announce a few days ago that essentially it's a three-pronged policy when it comes to what he wants to accomplish: no nuclear weapons, no ballistic missiles, and a longer sunset period on the original agreement. Now, we were well on the road to no nuclear weapons, but the agreement was never intended to cover ballistic missiles. And, you know, the longer sunset period is, you know, that's something that comes up in negotiations. I think there's also another unstated prong that most administrations have had, and that is to control Iranian activities in the Middle East, both, you know, by its Revolutionary Guard and other forces, or by its proxies like Hezbollah. So, you know, the president has set out a stated policy vis-a-vis Iran, and it'll be interesting to see if then he is able to put together a team and a program of action to achieve those goals.
Now, the president stopped short of saying, he implied that it was Iran who had attacked this Saudi Arabian oil facility. There's been talk about the sophistication of the attack, indicating its origin. But then he sort of stops short of saying that. The Iranians, what do they have to gain? What do they have to lose? Do they have less to lose from making an attack like this because of America's departure from the nuclear deal? Does that play into it? What would be behind this attack, and what's to gain, what's to lose for Iran?
I think what, you know, essentially the goal of the attack was to show the Saudis that, you know, while they can attack anything in Yemen and perhaps anything in Iran, Saudi Arabia is also open for attack as well. And yeah, the big question is, what role did the Iranians play? I think most people would agree that this attack couldn't have occurred without some Iranian involvement. Now, whether the Iranians were involved directly remains to be seen. Oftentimes, the Iranians adopt kind of an old CIA approach of plausible deniability, that people know that Iran had something to do with it. They provided the training, they provided the resources, but they didn't get their hands completely dirty on their own. There may not be a smoking gun. And so Iran probably played a role, but not a direct role. And I would argue that Iran has nothing to gain from a direct role, because so far both Iran and Saudi Arabia are intent in pursuing their Cold War through proxy forces, that they do not want to encounter each other face to face. And that's one reason why I would doubt that the Iranians did this directly. But I have no doubt that there was at least some level of involvement by the Iranian government.
All right. This is something that, as you said, could change minute by minute, especially in the age of Twitter, as language can change pretty quickly. Tim Shorns, the talk is called Permanent Tension, Iran, the United States, and the World. And you can see him at South Dakota State University tonight. Going into enemy territory yourself there, USD's Dr. Tim Shorns.
I probably won't wear red this evening, but you know, there may be just a small USD symbol somewhere in my presentation.
I think it's allowed.
Fly the flag rather subtly, but I'm looking forward to going to Brookings. It's always a great time, and they're always great hosts.
Yeah, we're all on the same team here, aren't we? Okay. Yep. So that talk is at 7 o'clock. It's in the Oscar Larson Performing Arts Center and Founders Recital Hall. Tim Shorns, always a pleasure. It's great that we can just ask you anything about this, and you'll help put it in perspective for us here in South Dakota. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, and I hope I leave people a little less confused.